history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around us. There are men and women with incredible stories to tell if we'll take the time to ask a few questions and listen to their memories. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, we're always inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today, what a beautiful spot we are in. I'm looking right out the window at Bear Mountain in Wyoming near the town of LaGrange, but it's pretty rural where we are right now. This is a cowboy life with snow all over the place right now, but we're talking to a real cowboy. In fact, a Hall of Fame cowboy, John Sussex, 91 years old. But you didn't grow up in Wyoming. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Goodland, Kansas.
How big a place is that?
Oh, it was just a farm town, I guess. Pretty good sized town at that. It's a small town, though. That's where I was raised, Sherman County, Kansas.
Did you have a big family? Did you have siblings?
I had two sisters older than me and one brother younger. That was all of us.
And you grew up on a farm?
Yeah.
What'd you have to do out there on the farm?
Whatever my dad told me to do. I'd drive a tractor or gather cows or whatever. We had a lot of horses and cows.
And I know it gets pretty cold and windy out here in Wyoming, but how does that compare to what you experienced in Kansas? It gets pretty windy out there, too, doesn't it?
There's nothing to stop the wind but a barbed wire fence. That's it.
And what do you remember about that childhood? Was it a simple life? Was it a carefree life? Did you feel the effects of the Great Depression? What do you remember about those years?
I remember the Dust Bowl days. I remember my mother lighting a kerosene light at noon so she could see in the kitchen because the dust was blowing so bad. And that was in the Dust Bowl days, in the 30s.
And did all that have an effect on your family and the farm and your guys' ability to stay there and live there?
I think in those years, my dad finally lost his place. And we moved to Colorado, and he went to work for somebody else. And nobody had any money in those days. Everybody, the whole country went broke.
Well, so how did that affect you? How did you process all that? Was that a shock to your system, or was it just one day at a time for you?
It turned me off of farming. Somebody else can do the farming. If you can't make it living sitting on a horse, you do. Might as well forget it.
Uh-huh. Well, I know your life has backed that up. And I wonder, you think you could count how many hours or days or years you've spent on horseback? What percentage of your actual waking hours in your 91 years do you think you spent on horseback?
I spent all my life on horseback except the time I was in the Army and overseas. And when I was in the Army, I was in the cavalry. So I took basic training on a horse in Fort Riley, Kansas.
Well, I bet you remember something about December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
I really can't remember.
You were pretty young. You were must have been just starting high school. Do you remember friends of yours leaving for the service or young men around town disappearing all of a sudden?
No, not really. I didn't, but pretty soon I disappeared with them.
And was that your choice or Uncle Sam's choice?
That was my choice. I joined the Army right out of high school.
Why'd you do that? What was your motivation?
I don't know. Just headstrong, I guess. My dad had a deferment for me, and I didn't take it. I went ahead and joined the Army.
Was the deferment to work on a farm or what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It was an agricultural deferment.
So you didn't have to go. You could have stayed here. You could have sat out the whole war and not put your life in danger at all. But you chose to volunteer. Were you at all concerned that that might be a fateful decision that didn't let you come back to America?
I don't ever remember being afraid, and I never thought about getting killed. Just that simple.
When everybody hears what you went through, I think they might be surprised in light of what you just said, that you never had those fears. But tell me about your training. You said you trained with the cavalry. What kind of stuff did you do?
We trained the horseback on just basic training and learned to shoot rifles and All that, just the normal stuff. And we did train with horses. But from there, we went overseas, and we took a boatload of mules with us. But we lost them in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. Before you tell us everything that happened there, what was the plan? And you're just a teenager still, but what did you understand about what you were supposed to do?
Well, I don't know, just what every other kid did, I guess. I joined up and ended up on a life raft out in the middle of the Indian Ocean for a week.
But they send you out of San Pedro, California, on a ship with you and some other guys in your outfit, and then a whole lot of animal companions. You had over 300 mules with you? What were you guys going to be doing with all those mules?
Packing over the hump in Burma. We were supposed to go to India, Calcutta, and from there we would use those mules to pack food and army supplies over the hump in Burma into China. But we never did make it there.
You were going to join up with Merrill's Marauders and deliver the supplies that way. And when you say go over the hump, now I know you have mountains here in Wyoming, and we're pretty up high altitude right now, sitting here talking by the fire. But you can go to the Grand Tetons here, and those are pretty high. But those mountains don't come close to what you guys were going to pack over. Did you understand how extreme this was going to be to pack those mules over those kind of elevations?
No, I never thought about it, never even worried about it. I don't ever remember being afraid or upset about it.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, that was the first go-around on a ship, too.
How'd you take to that?
I took all right to it. I didn't get seasick like a lot of guys did. I'd stand up on the bow and watch them big fish from the head of that old boat. And that old boat would only go about 7 knots, and that was it. There was no Liberty ship.
Well, and when you're on a slow ship out there like that, and you've probably heard that other ships have been sunk by submarines, you still weren't scared? Didn't think maybe they could get you?
No, never thought about it. Mm-hmm. Never thought about getting killed.
Did you see anything interesting on that voyage? Because from California to the Indian Ocean is a long way. Which way did you guys go, and what did you see?
We loaded on a San Pedro and shipped out there. And I don't remember how long it was. They torpedoed that ship. We lost all of our mules and some of the men. We ended up on two of them old wooden 8x8. Life rafts tied together. There were 17 of us on them two rafts.
Where were you when the ship got hit?
I was sleeping in a mule chute. I didn't sleep down in the hold like the rest of the men. I didn't like it down there. I made myself a bed out of an old army I caught up in one of them mule chutes that we loaded the mules on. And they was things, the chutes that we could pick up with the cables and stuff and lift them off the dock and set them down on the boat. And that's what I slept in. And when they torpedoed that ship, I rattled around in that mule chute like a rubber bowl.
Well, and you can laugh about that, but I'm just imagining that may have been a life-saving decision for you to sleep up there as opposed to down below. Were there guys in those sleeping quarters down below who were killed in that submarine attack?
Yes, there was. And I went ahead and got out of that mule chute, dressed completely, even put my shoes or boots on and everything. So when that boat sunk and we got on the life raft, I was completely dressed and even had my boots on. Never got those boots off for a week.
Well, how chaotic was that scene? Can you help us understand how quickly it was sinking or what was going on aboard that ship and the atmosphere around you as you're trying to figure out what just happened?
No, that they torpedoed that ship in the middle, and it broke in two. And then they torpedoed the number one hold, and that front half of that ship broke off from the back half and sunk. And I remember seeing the back half float away. There was, I think, two men in the engine room on the back half that was still in that back half of that ship when it floated away. That's all I remember.
And did you get to this wooden raft right away, or did you have to scramble to figure out where it was?
No, we knew where it was. My buddy and I had that thing tied to where we got off of that ship, and we ended up with two of them tied together, and there were 17 of us on those two rafts when we finally floated away. And when we did, the back half of that ship was still floating out there in the ocean. I don't know how long it floated, but I think it finally sunk too. But there was two men in the engine room, they told me, that couldn't get out.
Did you lose guys that you had gotten to know, that you had trained with, that you were friends with?
Oh, yeah. We lost men, and we lost all of our mules and everything. We got out of there with the clothes we had on our back, and that's it.
So as you described it, the ship is hit in the middle, and then again in the front, two torpedoes hit this Liberty ship. So you've got probably guys without rafts trying to float in the water. You've got hundreds of mules in the water. And I don't want to compare the life of a mule to the life of a man, but I imagine that you had a bond with those mules if you'd been training with them and you were expected to pack them across the Himalayas. What was it like to see this devastation and realize there's nothing you can do to save men or to save those animals?
You don't worry about it. You just keep going with your own deal. The boys that worried about it is the ones that would get you killed because they couldn't think. They was afraid, and they couldn't help it. I don't remember being afraid. And I remember a mule trying to get on the raft with us, and I had to knock him off with a short tibufo that was floating by to keep him off. There wasn't room for him on the raft.
Yeah.
The mules, of course, didn't make it, and a lot of the men didn't make it.
Well, and that comes to mind, too. Were you able to help some other guys get to the raft or get them aboard? Did you see guys struggling that were trying to find something to float with?
Yeah, if anybody went by and they was needing some help, you can just reach out and help them, that's all.
And what time of day was it when this happened? You said you were asleep, but was this at night? Was it in the morning?
10:30 at night, and the moon come out about then, and that sub that sunk our boat come up about then when we finally got on those rafts, and it went around and out of sight. It went around where our ship was, what was left floating, because the back half of that ship broke in two, and the back half of it was floating. And that submarine come out of the water and come out and went around. And I saw it fire two shots. I saw two tracer bullets in the sky. And that's all the last time I ever saw it. I don't know where it went from there, but that was it.
So again, I'm just trying to imagine what this is like. You're out in the ocean. You're on a raft. It's dark out. You get a little moonlight. Was there fire anywhere on the ship or anything that gave some more light? Or was it hard to see? Could you tell what was out there?
No, you couldn't. It was dark. It was 10:30 at night.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see. I think the moon did, the clouds moved a little, and the moon did come out one time, I remember. That's all. That's been a long time ago. I can't remember everything.
But there are also some things he can't ever forget, and we'll hear about it when we come back. What other hazards did John Sussex and those other survivors face? How did he finally get out of that predicament? And what else did he do during World War II? We'll explore those questions and more with 91-year-old John Sussex of LaGrange, Wyoming. For photos of what he looked like during the war or on horseback, or his view of Bear Mountain right outside his house, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to explore a unique story today in Goshen County, Wyoming, where the wide open spaces bring to mind that old classic, Home on the Range. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to explore a unique story today in Goshen County, Wyoming, where the wide open spaces bring to mind that old classic, Home on the Range. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. That, of course, is the unofficial anthem of the American West. It actually became the state song of John Sussex's native Kansas after World War II, but his post-war life in Wyoming made me think of a different song we're going to sample in a moment. It never ceases to amaze me how many remarkable individual stories are out there, often buried inside the memories of humble heroes who never sought any attention for what they went through. They were all part of a monumental effort to turn back the tide of tyranny during World War II, when 16 million Americans put on those military uniforms and risked their lives. While that was happening around the globe, so many more went all in on the home front, and there's so much that we can learn today from the different textures on this historic tapestry, the unity, the resolve, the collective determination in the big picture, and the jaw-dropping details when we zero in on the personal experiences of these folks who at the time were very young but courageous Americans who we have the privilege of meeting all over this country. If we're ever foolish enough to think we've heard it all we have to do is wait a while, and more of these captivating and inspiring stories will remind us we'll never hear it all. And I've got to say, just on a personal level of transparency here, sometimes I can settle into a routine, a formula, an expectation of the general trajectory of what the veterans we meet here are going to have to say. Maybe you do that too, as a listener. But then along comes a flurry of jarring reminders that the power and the intrigue and diversity of the untold stories still probably outweighs what we have heard. I think you're going to feel that as we hear the rest of John Sussex's survival story today, as we move on next week to a man in a small Colorado town who survived some incredibly close calls in the Navy in World War II and continues to contribute in ways that I think will really move you. And then when we begin Black History Month in February with a Renaissance man in California who rose above some of the worst possible examples of discrimination to become a pioneering heart surgeon. Just preparing for those programs has energized and encouraged me, and I can't wait to share those stories with you, but we've waited long enough to dive back into John Sussex's story. For more than 60 years now, he's lived in LaGrange, Wyoming, right along the old Texas cattle trail. In fact, I promise I'm not making this up, on my way to his home, we hit the kind of traffic jam you're never going to find in most of the places where we meet our hometown heroes. There was a herd of cattle covering both lanes of the snow-lined road as they moseyed toward lower elevation with two cowboys on horseback showing them the way. It made me think of the life that John Sussex lived after surviving his harrowing ordeal in World War II, and it also made me think of a song that I've got to warn you might stick in your head a little bit. It might as well have been written about our guest today. Take a listen.
Well, he's up at the crack of dawn, cinching that saddle on. Storming hard and things are looking mighty grim. There's a long ride ahead that day, chopping ice and beating hay. Cause he knows every critter's life depends on him. And hat and a leather vest.
Best cowboy,
a great American cowboy. With a horse and a rope and a gun, he tamed the west. Well, he's up at the crack of dawn, putting that bacon on. Winter is past and the skies are clear and blue. There's springtime everywhere, and the dogies are a-pollockin' there. And he's thanking the Lord once more for seeing them through. Cowboy, great American cowboy. Big high boots, Stetson hat, and a leather vest.
Best cowboy,
great American cowboy. With a horse and a rope and a gun, he tamed the west.
Told you it was catchy. I'm kind of tempted to let it just keep on going. That's written by one of my personal heroes, Jack Hanna, the Sons of the San Joaquin there, singing Great American Cowboy, because we're meeting a great American cowboy today. That is no exaggeration when it comes to John Sussex. John just lost his wife of 68 years, Juanita, in December. But in 2016, John and Neets, as everyone knew her in Wyoming, were inducted together into the Wyoming Cowboy Hall of Fame. That never would have happened. In fact, he never would have even met his wife if he hadn't survived what I think most of us would describe as a terrifying situation during World War II. We're going to peel back a little more of the broad scope of this story in a bit, but you heard him refer to floating 7 days in the Indian Ocean after the ship that 175 men and almost twice that many mules were taking toward India was torpedoed and sunk by a German submarine.
You know, you're sitting here with a smile on your face and saying all this like it's no big deal, and everybody else is saying, how in the world do you handle a situation like that as a teenager? You really weren't scared at all?
No, I don't remember being afraid. You've got a job to do. You keep your mind on what you have to do and get her done. That's just that simple. The guys that got afraid will get you killed. They screw things up.
So you have those two 8x8 wooden rafts tied together. You said 17 men total on the two of them. Were any of those guys wounded at all, injured?
No, one guy died, and they finally had to slide him off and into the water. Because we floated out there for 7 days and nights.
Well, that's what I was going to get to, because we're just hearing 10:30 at night, that first night. And you don't know what's going to happen. You probably don't have any idea really where you are. Did you know where you were?
No, didn't even worry about it. You just take care of the things that you had to do. And the guys that was afraid are the guys that would get you into trouble.
Did you sleep that night on the raft?
I never stayed awake to see.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm imagining you go through that. It's a nightmare. I mean, it's nothing anyone could imagine, nothing that anything can prepare you for. And then in the morning when you wake up, you're probably wishing it was a dream, but it's not. And then you can finally see, because the sun's out. What did you see when you woke up that next morning?
Water. A lot of it. You couldn't see a horizon anywhere. The only thing you could see, as far as you could see, was water.
Was it, were the waves choppy? Was it a calm sea?
There were swells, and if you was in a trough, you'd look up and you could see the water up above you. Then that swell would move and you'd be on top of it and you could see the horizon all the way around. It was just that simple. You know, you couldn't see land anywhere.
You can't see land. You don't know where you are. You don't know if there are Japanese in the area. You don't know probably if any Americans know that you guys were even sunk, right?
I guess so. What you do is don't worry about it. Just do what you have to do to keep it going, that's all.
Well, and that's the question. What do you do? You've got 17 guys there. Were you guys talking to each other? Was everybody quiet? What was happening there?
We didn't have any food. We had a little bit of K rations and some canned water. And we didn't just tip them water cans up and drink all we could hold. It finally got to where that water didn't hardly get past our mouth to swallow it. Our mouth was pretty dry. But we kind of nursed it along so we'd have it as long as we could, you know.
Well, and you can look back now and you know it was 7 days. But at the time, you have no idea how long this is going to be or who's going to pick you up or if you're ever going to see your family again, if you're ever going to see America again. What kind of stuff went through your mind while you were out there?
We never thought about that. After 5 days, a plane flew over and circled and found us. And when they left, they fired 2 shots. And 2 days later, a Coast Guard cutter come out of Australia and picked us up. Just that simple.
Those had to be the longest 2 days of your life.
Never thought about it. We just floated around till somebody come along and picked us up. And
did you already know all those guys? Did you get to know them during that time?
Oh, yeah. You're sitting on 2 rafts, 8 by 8 foot rafts tied together. You get to know them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The one buddy of yours you had been really good friends with, was it Fraley? Was that his name?
Yeah. Yeah, we got out of there we all got out of there all right. Yeah.
Well, tell me about him. What was his story? Who was he? What was he like?
He was just about like me. He just took it as it come. I never did see him get excited, neither. There wasn't no use in getting all shook up. But he just had to handle things as they come down the trail, I guess. And that's the way he was, too.
Did you see anything in the water? I mean, would you see any sea life, any sharks, anything else?
Yeah, we did. Even tried to catch a fish. I think I made a fishing hook out of a pin that had a life light tied onto a vest, you know. And I did catch a fish, and he looked like he was about 18 inches long, and then my stupid pin straightened out, and he got away. If he hadn't, we'd have probably ate him. So he lived because he got that pin straightened out and let him go.
Well, maybe that's a metaphor, because you were kind of like that fish, weren't you?
Yeah, I guess so.
You said you had a few K rations and some cans of water. How long did that hold out? When did you run out of that?
We didn't run out because we rationed ourselves. And they finally found us, and a plane flew over, and after 5 days, and when they left, they circled and flew over us. They fired 2 shots. 2 days later, a Coast Guard cutter come and picked us up.
You mentioned one of the guys, one of those 17, did die before you guys were rescued. What happened to him?
Well, he wasn't on our raft, but they just had to push him off into the water. He'd been wounded, but he didn't make it, and they couldn't keep him on that life raft. You know, he was dead, so they had to push him off and get rid of him.
I know you keep telling me you weren't afraid and nothing bothered you, but that's got to be hard to see another one of those guys have to suffer that fate.
He wasn't on our raft. He was on one of them other ones. There were 17 of us on our 2 rafts that we had tied together.
And were there other rafts floating around those two?
Oh, yeah. And when that boat went down, there was mules swimming around. I know one tried to get on the raft with us, and I picked up a piece of 2x4. It was about 2 feet long. Tapped him on the head, and he slid off into the water because there wasn't no place for a mule on that raft.
And you said you guys rationed what little food you had and the water you had, but was there some discussion about that? Were there some folks that wanted it more than others? Did someone have to take charge in that situation and lead and keep the other guys from wasting it?
No, everybody worked at it, you know. We didn't have any food to speak of. Some K rations, but them K rations didn't amount to that much. And when we pass that water can around, we'd just take a swallow. We wouldn't just tip it up and drink because there were 17 of us on them 2 rafts.
Yes, and there were 75 others on other rafts and a lifeboat who were rescued the same day John was. The bulk of the 142 survivors of the SS Peter Sylvester spent a week lost at sea, but believe it or not, 20 more lasted another 2 weeks before being picked up by a British ship
And incredibly, 15 more survivors were able to make it 32 days at sea in a lifeboat before their long-awaited rescue. We'll try to dig even deeper with 91-year-old John Sussex of LaGrange, Wyoming, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Hey, this is Paul Leffler from the Hometown Heroes program, and I don't want you to miss out on a powerful exhibit that's traveling the country. Courage and Compassion, our shared story of the Japanese-American World War II experience, is in Kingsburg until February 4th at the Kingsburg Historical Park. Take your family, take your school group, take everyone you know, because this free exhibit will help you understand sacrifice, perseverance, community, and the value of freedom. For more information, call 559-410-0488.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old John Sussex, a Hall of Fame cowboy who will always prefer the saddle to an 8-foot by 8-foot raft in the Indian Ocean. He'd also prefer the driver's seat of General Douglas MacArthur's car. That's a seat he occupied several months later while running a motor pool in the Philippines. He had to deliver that car to MacArthur's driver. Of course, he never would have made it to that moment if he didn't survive on that raft for one unforgettable week as an 18-year-old during World War II. The Liberty ship SS Peter Sylvester was headed from California all the way to India, where the teenager was supposed to help lead a team of 317 mules through the Himalayas to resupply Merrill's marauders in Burma. Before they ever made it to Calcutta, the German submarine U-862, captained by Heinrich Timm, torpedoed the ship on February 6, 1945. You heard John Sussex describe his memories from that night. 33 Americans would die, but he became one of the 142 who survived. You're hearing a pretty consistent message from John that makes it clear he's never dwelled too heavily on, or at least not gotten too sentimental about, the 7 days that he spent floating on that raft. Having no idea, of course, what the future might hold, but we can ask a few more questions and let's see what he's willing to share with us. How hungry did you get?
I don't know. I never thought about it. When they picked us up, they gave us something to eat. I think my belly had shrunk my stomach because it didn't take very much to fill it up. I really don't know. I couldn't eat that much anyway.
How thirsty did you get?
We got to where we took that water. Not very much of it got down our throat. It just kind of disappeared into our mouth.
So did your mouth get dry and start swelling up on you?
Oh, yeah, it got dry, but nothing was swelling up that I can remember. That's been a long time ago. I can't remember all that stuff.
And what about, you said you had your whole uniform on and your boots on and all that, but what were the conditions like? Was it hot during the day?
It was hot, yeah. We had to protect ourselves from the sun, and it did cloud up and rain once, I remember.
That probably felt good.
I remember catching a swallow or two of water in a can that had cut open. When it started raining, I opened one of them cans up with my knife. I had a knife in my belt, and it wasn't just a little knife. It was a big knife, and I cut that can open, and I held it up and caught 2 or 3 swallows of water.
Well, obviously, I've never been through anything like this. I'm sure almost everybody, if not everybody listening, has never been through anything like this. But I have talked to a few other guys who've been in similar situations, including Louis Zamperini, who they made that movie about, Unbroken, where he was on a raft for 47 days
and finally picked up by the Japanese and then tortured and all that. And he talked about some of the guys hallucinating. He talked about himself praying and promising God that if he ever got him out of that, you know, what he would do in return. Did you have any of those mental gymnastics? Did you take time and pray? Did you think about your family back home? Because that's a lot of time to pass, a whole week out there on a raft with nothing else to do.
I remember thanking God for keeping me alive, that's all.
You know, I've talked to some guys who were sunk on the Indianapolis, and of course the famous element to that story is the shark attack, and a lot of guys died in that fashion. Did you have any concerns about sharks? Were you looking out for them?
Didn't need to. They were swimming around our raft. They was there. We just didn't stick our feet out in the water or put our hands in it because of those sharks. They was around our raft. And so we just stayed on the raft and stayed out of the water all we could.
So the fins were circling you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, those sharks.
You realize, for us, it sounds crazy when that's not a big deal to you. I mean, your life is at stake here, and those sharks can eat you, and they're right there. But didn't bother you.
Why should it? We were sitting on the raft. They was in the water. We didn't stick our hands or anything in the water, so, and they wasn't bothering us, but they was big sharks and swimming around our rafts and stuff.
How close would you say they were to the raft?
Just as close as they could get.
They ever bump your raft?
I don't remember anything like that.
But if you fell over, you're shark bait.
Yep.
Was that a lot of the 7 days where they were in the area, or is that just every once in a while?
That was just once in a while. They didn't just stay around all the time. They'd come and go.
Well, after 6 or 7 days, they probably thought you guys were so skinny you weren't good eating anyway, huh?
Probably. Yeah, I imagine.
Is there anything else that you remember about what I have to imagine was the longest week of your life? The things that happened, the things you saw, the things people might have said, or the thoughts that ran through your mind?
No, I don't remember anything. You know, we all just had to live with what had happened.
And he's been living with that for 73 years since the sinking of the SS Peter Sylvester on February 6, 1945. History records the Sylvester as the last ship sunk by a German submarine in the Indian Ocean in World War II. Among those oh so thankful that John survived are 8 great-grandchildren, 6 grandkids, and 2 sons. His older son, Tim, facilitated this visit in LaGrange. Let's get a little bit of his perspective. Well, do you remember the first time that you heard this story about what happened to your dad during the war?
Yeah, I remember. You know, he's told about it several times and stuff. So, yeah, there's some things that he's said and has not said. So,
did that blow your mind the first time you heard it?
Well, I was pretty young, so I didn't totally take it all in. But as years going on, yeah, I have. It was quite a feat.
So, Tim, have you ever imagined yourself in that position that your dad was in as a teenager with his ship sinking underneath him and floating in the water for 7 days?
No, I guess I hadn't thought about it that way on myself. So I was going to join the service, and then I ended up going to college and didn't make it.
What about this thought that if he doesn't survive that, you never would have been born?
I guess not.
Does that get to you at all, or are you like your dad, nothing bothers you?
Well, I just don't, I guess, think about some of that stuff that way. So do my own thing. But when he did tell me when he was 18, he was over there in the islands. He turned 18 years old, so he's pretty young when he left here.
Yeah, for sure.
He didn't get his diploma. He graduated, but he never went and picked it up. So he done left early.
And your dad didn't really want to tell me about his action toward the end of the war, after he spent that time in the hospital, after he recovered from the ordeal in the raft, for which he earned a Purple Heart, by the way. But your wife just handed me an account that he typed up a few years back, and I'm going to have to read some of that. Your dad saw action on the island of Morotai, on Corregidor, on Luzon. Anything he's told you about that that you want to share before I go back to him?
Well, you know, he's seen a lot of action, and tell him about digging his foxholes and being in there for a week or so at a time and never taking your boots off. He was a scout. Uh-huh. He'd go out and scout in the dark and find where the enemies were and report and stuff. So it wasn't just California to the life raft back. He was over there quite a while.
Well, I know this may be a tough one to answer or to put it succinctly, but take all the time you need. What have you learned from your dad? What has his example or influence or impact on your life been?
Well, to be truthful and do it right and do a good day's work and enjoy it. He enjoyed life. Him and Mom would go out and have some parties and whatnot. And in Montana, they did a lot of that. And so just be yourself and be kind and no shenanigans.
Uh-huh. Anything else you want to say about him?
No, he's a good man.
Well, what more satisfying words can a father hear from a son? But I want to go back to the father while we still have some time. Tim tells me that once he actually got on land and got a gun in your hand, that you were a scout going out at night to figure out where the enemy is. That true?
Yeah.
That's not an easy job.
Well, it's just a job. You had to do it. Don't worry about it. Go do your job and that's it.
I know you weren't scared out on the raft, but how about doing that in a dark jungle? Was that nerve-wracking?
Not really. You wouldn't have wanted to walk up behind me and tap me on the shoulder. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have been safe. You know, we was trained to kill people, and we had hand-to-hand combat, so all it takes to kill somebody is just these.
Yeah, your hands. You're holding up your hands, and I don't know if you've ever asked yourself this question, but I'm interested to know, and maybe some of our listeners are. So if you had your choice of a foxhole in the jungle or a wooden raft on the ocean, which one you taking?
Neither one. I'd stay out here.
And again, I know you're not looking for attention and you're not melodramatic, but I would count the sinking of your ship and surviving for 7 days on the raft as a pretty close call.
Yeah.
Did you have any other close calls after that in combat that you remember?
Well, I guess, but I can't remember. I don't. You just leave that stuff behind you and go on.
Never got hit?
Nope.
How close do you think they came?
Pretty close. When the bullet goes past you and it pops, that pop is the air coming in behind the bullet. So it might only be about 3 inches from you as it goes by. But a miss is a miss, so don't worry about it. If you didn't get hit, keep going. I never did get hit.
Have you been back to Washington, D.C., to the World War II Memorial since they built it?
Yes, I have. They flew a bunch of us back there one time.
Honor Flight Wyoming?
Yeah.
What did you think about when you were there at that memorial where they honor 406,000 Americans who didn't come home?
I never thought about it. I just looked things over, and it was interesting to see. And so it was an honor to be there and see all that stuff. Yeah.
And all those gold stars, that represents 406,000 lives. Some of those stars represent guys that were on your ship that didn't make it, and others guys that were fighting with you in the jungles and didn't make it. Did you think about those guys when you were there?
Oh, yeah, but you can't think about all of them. You don't keep thinking about that stuff, and you put it on a shelf and leave it behind you. The guys that gets a little dingy is the ones that keeps bringing it back and thinking about it all the time.
And clearly, we've heard that's how you feel. And perhaps putting it on that metaphorical shelf is what allowed you to live that life of the great American cowboy here in Wyoming. And with your permission here, I'm going to read something from that shelf, so to speak, something you wrote a few years ago so your family would know what happened. There are some details in here that are going to add to what you've already shared with us. You mentioned that it took you 28 days to get to Melbourne, Australia. You were there for a day and a half, got water and food, and headed back out. You mentioned that the mules, those 300-plus mules on the ship, their bellies would swell up, so we would take them out and exercise them on top of the number one hold, and then some down in the hold. The mules would get kind of cranky. I was checking the mules in the number one hold one night with a flashlight. We were in enemy waters, so I held my hand over the flashlight and let just a little light between my fingers. A mule grabbed me by the side of my left hip and picked me clear up off the deck, scared the heck out of me for a second. Then it made me mad. I beat on his head with my flashlight until he dropped me. That was entertaining. And you talk about heading out toward Calcutta, 10:30 at night, as you told us, a heck of an explosion, as you write, and you bounced around in that chute like a rubber ball, just like you said. A submarine had been following us, and they'd shot two torpedoes in the number two hold, one right after another. You mentioned Marvin Fraley. You say when Fraley and I got organized, we went over to the number one hold where the torpedoes hit. It was dark and a lot of noise.
We went back to where the rafts were. There were two of them. I don't know who cut them loose. I asked Fraley how he got out of that hold, and he said that he climbed one of those steel beams. They told us to abandon ship, and everybody tried to go down the ladder at once. I told them to line up, and they did, and down they went. I guess that's where discipline comes in. Everyone got off the ship and on the raft. Then a sailor came up and needed help. Fraley, a cook named Frank Kolb, and another guy Kolb called Junior and I went back aboard. Fraley and I held the ropes to the rafts, and the other two went with the sailor on the bow up to the gun to help the sailor. I saw Fraley put something in his mouth, and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm taking a chew. Do you want one? It's gonna get wet." I said no. About a minute later, another torpedo hit in the number one hold on the other side of the ship from where we were standing. Hatch lids were flying everywhere, and water was coming down so hard you had to bend over to breathe. I think Fraley lost his chew about then. We had to jump off that time. I threw two blankets on the rafts the first time we got off. That gave us one for each raft. We got on the rafts again. The bow of the ship was going down. When it did, the back half of the ship came straight up in the air. The bow went down, and we floated right under the stern that was on end. When I looked up and saw that, I slid off of the raft and swam away. I thought the back end was going to fall on us. The ship broke in half, and the back end settled back down. I swam back to the raft. I was getting tired, and a mule swam by and gave me a push that helped me get back to the raft. You talk about how there were mules floating everywhere. There were things floating everywhere. The two rafts were tied together, but then you heard motors running. The submarine came out of the water about 100 feet from us. We all slid off of the raft, hoping they wouldn't see us. The submarine went on around. We heard shots and saw tracer bullets, and I guess she went on because we never saw it anymore. When it got so we could see the next morning, we could still see the back half of the ship still afloat. There were 17 of us on the two rafts. The rafts were wooden, 8x8, with airtight tanks around the outside. We could still see the back half of the ship on the horizon that evening. We floated for 5 days before we saw anything. We found out later that one boat went back to the ship and got water and wine out of the captain's quarters. They said they could hear the men in the engine room, but there was no way they could get them out. I heard that the back half of the ship floated for 2 or 3 days before it finally sunk. The men in the engine room went down with it. The lifeboat that went back got picked up in 2 days. That was the first that anybody knew we had been sunk. Then they started looking for the rest of us. It stayed cloudy most of the time that we were on the rafts. We had some pemmican and some canned water. We couldn't eat because it made us thirsty. We had a little container about as round as a 50-cent piece and about 5 inches long. We drank 2 of those a day. Well, it says it right here, there were sharks around us all the time. You talk about catching that fish that eventually got away. After 5 days, we heard a plane, and we sent up a flare, and they came over us and dropped some supplies, but because of the sharks, we couldn't get to them. You left that part out before. The plane fired 2 shots when they left. 2 days later, a Coast Guard cutter came and picked us up. We'd been on the raft 7 days and 7 nights. When we were picked up, they got a submarine alert. They didn't waste any time picking us off the rafts and sinking them. They put us in the galley and gave us some soup. I think after about 2 spoonfuls, we were full. They locked the hatch down, and from the galley we could see a gun sticking out of a port in the side of the ship. We were going pretty fast and circling and dropping depth charges. I suppose that submarine had been keeping track of us all that time. It sure was hard to sit there when all of that was going on. They finally quit, and we headed out for Australia. And then it talks about recovering in Australia, eventually being deployed to fight on Morotai. You went to Corregidor, and then on to Luzon, and you finished the war as a driver for a general named Boleyn. Boy, I'm sure glad that this came off the shelf, and we had a chance to add some of those details to everything that you've shared with us today. Thank you so much, Mr. Sussex. Once a cowboy, always a cowboy, and he's got the photos from age 2 to almost 92 that'll prove that. You can check out some of those photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find more information about the sinking and the survivors of the SS Peter Sylvester, the very last ship sunk by a German submarine in the Indian Ocean during World War II. 33 men were killed in addition to those 317 mules, but what a privilege today to get to know a little bit about one of the last remaining survivors out of 142 who made it through. And as this edition of Hometown Heroes rides off into the sunset, why don't we let the Sons of the San Joaquin give John Sussex a proper cowboy exit.
Cowboy! Great American cowboy! With a horse and a rope.
I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
With a horse and a rope and a gun, he takes.